You're listening to the Dismantling Normal podcast. I'm Megan Schaefer, and when my perfectly curated normal life blew up and took my standard list of checkboxes with it, I reevaluated everything. I stopped hustling for my worth and found freedom in coloring outside the lines. Join me for authentic, curious conversations that unravel the baggage, bias, and distance our perceptions of normal create. Let's find out what happens when we stop being normal and start being real. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Dismantling Normal. I am so excited for you to hear this conversation today. Thank you for being here. It is a conversation with my friend Jillian, who I met on social media. And yeah, apparently you can make legit connections and friends via the interwebs. You'll even hear me ask how she pronounces her name because I had never heard her say it out loud. So yeah, the strange beauty of social media right here. But I was drawn to her account because her handle is Mental Health Wife on Instagram. She's at Mental Health Wife. And I wanted to know more about what was behind that. So Jillian does take us through her kind of advocacy journey and tells us what advocacy looks like for her, how she defines it, why she does it, because any type of advocacy can take on many forms, and it's really so deeply personal and comes from personal situations. So we do talk about Jillian's own story and what she has gone through with her husband, but gosh, she tells us how she met him and how he proposed, and I'm telling you, it's like a scene right out of a romantic comedy feature. It's so great. I love it. But we know nothing goes that smoothly. The scripts are not written for us. And certainly they navigated some pretty severe mental health challenges very early in their marriage and hospitalization. And Jillian talks about what that looked like and how things presented then and what things look like now. One of the most interesting things I find about learning someone's backstory, like the full story, are the things behind the thing. Prior to my dad's cancer diagnosis, I always kind of thought that the diagnosis, that moment when you are sitting there, the doctor's giving you the news, and again, maybe this is because I've watched too many movies, but the doctor is telling you the thing, and that would be the heaviest, most pivotal, painful moment in the whole situation. Like, you're just hit with it, and then, you know, you rise up and move on from there. But that is not reality. I mean, as bad as that moment is, it's bad. It's the day-to-day things that change and become difficult or impossible, and the cumulative weight of a million tiny things that is the real suffering of any major trauma. And Jillian brings this idea up when she talks about moving a few months ago. So yeah, get this. They had to move pretty immediately. They had to get out of their living situation urgently. In the middle of a global pandemic, in the middle of hurricane season in Louisiana, because we know how hard they were hit this year. And then on top of that, global pandemic or not, Heath, Jillian's husband, is not comfortable leaving the house. We all know moving is terrible. But under those conditions, it is almost a miraculous feat. I couldn't end our conversation without asking Jillian how she takes care of herself. So we dive into self-care and meditation. Don't groan or roll your eyes. I agree that those two concepts are largely misinterpreted and misunderstood. And we talk about what they really are versus what people think they are. And I love Jillian's take on it. She said it is really all about coming back to herself. Think about that. Coming back to yourself. And what I find so interesting about this is the kind of trust in yourself this fosters. Like, trusting myself is a very real practice for me. I'm not good at it and I have to work at it. But I love this idea of getting really calm and quiet. And sometimes Jillian even does this in her car if it's necessary. And easing into what you think and what you need and your truth. And then getting really comfortable with the decisions that come out of that. In fact, this very idea segues right into our discussion about the idea of dismantling normal and what normal actually is or isn't. Oh, this was so fun. And honestly, this was a conversation I needed right now when I heard it for the second time, right on time, just this week. I hope you enjoy it too. And like I mentioned, you can find Jillian on Instagram under @mentalhealthwife. Okay, let's get to it. Okay, I first off have a question that on one hand is a little bit embarrassing to ask you because we have talked so much, but on the other hand also reflects the strangeness of meeting friends on social media. I have never pronounced your name out loud, and I don't know if it's Jillian or Gillian.
That is so funny. It's Jillian. It's Jillian.
That's what I thought.
Soft G.
Okay.
I may be like super hard ass sometimes, but it is a soft G. I've been learning that, like you said, I think it really has a lot to do with meeting people online because several people recently have asked me whether it's Gillian or Jillian. And I was like, really? That's so weird. Because most people I know on the day-to-day basis know it's Jillian. But if you just see it on paper, you wouldn't necessarily know.
Yeah, that was my assumption. But then I thought, well, I really should not assume. My name is spelled strange and people always wonder if it's Megan or Megan.
I was just going to ask you. Mm-hmm. I've been going with Megan.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, how are you?
I am good. I'm good. And I'm also odd. I almost texted you this morning to tell you about the weird oddity, but I am just going with it. And that I'm either I'm having this like lightheadedness today.
Uh-huh.
It's so odd. I woke up with it this morning and I'm not dizzy. I'm just lightheaded, like just a little whoosh here and there.
So is it happening right now? Is it still happening?
It's not happening as I do anything. It's just I'm very sensitive to light. I'm very sensitive to movement. So as I'm sitting, it's a lot less of a noticeable thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So all that to say, woozy, feel great, ready to do this no matter what, because it wasn't like a, whoa, I have a migraine thing or anything along those lines. It was more like, this is just where we are. Okay.
Well, at this point in your life, if you thought today was the only day that you've had in the past maybe year that something strange didn't happen, and so that was the reason you didn't want to record, I would have totally accepted that. And we'll definitely get to the move, the hurricane. In the middle of a global pandemic, mind you. I mean, you have had so much going on. But I want to start maybe more from the beginning. I reached out to you because when I started doing the podcast, I kind of categorized some different topics that I wanted to talk about. And your Instagram handle is Mental Health Wife, and your description is a mental health advocate. And I just wanted to learn more about your story. And funny enough, I mean, I contacted you way back in the beginning when this first started. And I'm kind of, I think it has kind of worked out really well that it didn't timing didn't work out to start, and that we've had all this time to get to know each other and become friends via social media. So yes, everybody, that actually happens. But I don't know a ton about your story or what prompted you to become the mental health advocate that you are.
True. And the funny thing is, sometimes I don't know that I am a mental health advocate until people reach out to me and ask me to either do something like this or give a talk. And that could be because I never really fully stepped into that as a role, as the role, like starring role of my life, mental health advocate. I think because I am, definitely somebody who has lots of interests, both professionally and personally, I think I fell into becoming an advocate because I really talk a lot about the things that are important to me. And that is sometimes how you advocate for a person, for yourself, a community, anything, right?
I agree. And I would categorize your advocacy the same as you are. It's more that you make it you are intentional about discussing it, about being transparent about your own life, about being transparent about what is important to you and what is important to your family around mental health. And I think that is where a big part of your advocacy lies.
Yes. Also, it just hit me as we're sitting here talking, I'm always amazed by the co-occurrence of things that are sort of energetic and things that are purposeful and intentful, and how the cross-section of the mm-hmm. two, three, however many things there really are going on at the same time. It just hit me that today is Suicide Awareness Day. Like the whole month is mental health awareness and suicide awareness. Well, it's mental health and suicide awareness. And there are people who are doing all kinds of programs today about suicide awareness. And it's really interesting that we planned this day now, like, I don't know, weeks ago to do this. And it didn't hit me until sitting here right now how that's what I mean. Hello.
Hi, Blue.
That's Blue Dog. He's also an advocate. So I was sitting here yesterday. I remember thinking about how I was trying to think that now, you know, I need to make sure that I'm letting people know that I'm available and I'm aware, and that if they need me, I'm here, because I've always felt as a person who is an intentional advocate that it's important to let people know that you're there for mm-hmm. them, period, especially around suicide awareness mm-hmm. For me. And so the fact that we planned this and then it is also Suicide Awareness Day is just exactly how I became a mental health advocate. It just, things that are supposed to happen for me do. They just happen. And as long as I follow through on them, mm-hmm. it moves me to the next step, mm-hmm. so to speak. But the other more bigger piece, I mean, story-wise, is becoming a mental health advocate definitely came out of my husband's mental health issues and challenges and crises and multiple ups and downs and hospitalizations and trying to figure out diagnoses, all of that. You literally have to have somebody in your life who can advocate for you, or you're very much on the struggle bus. That is definitely what I've seen for him. And so because I was able to do it for him, I feel like the folks who don't have anybody mm-hmm. need places to get either a person like myself to help them, or help connect the dots and, you know, or put them in touch with the right resources. And whether that is speaking at events, it's a real, like you said about, you know, how do you find yourself in that role?
Yeah.
I literally have done things like sit with 10 people in a park to talk about mental health advocacy or their struggles with mental health. And I consider that advocacy because I'm helping people who would otherwise not get what they need. Mm-hmm. That's why they met me in the park. But then also, you know, 60 people in a room at a spiritual center, or hundreds of people at a professional gathering, because I also have an MSW and a PhD. And one of the joys of that is that you get to do, you have to keep speaking and writing and things like that. And so there, prior to this pandemic, we had in-person live events, and everything I ever did research on always had a piece of the mental health in it, mm-hmm. even if it wasn't solely on mental health. Social behavioral research is super important to me because we all have a health, and part of that is mental health, which is another reason why my handle is Mental Health mm-hmm. Wife, mm-hmm. because I fully believe that there is a place amongst all of what we have going on that we can come to balance with our health, and both physical and mental. And that is one of the things I tried, I think, to show as much as I can, especially in the beginning when I started on social media, was that while I look like I have rose-colored glasses a lot, there's still things happening that need my attention, both for my husband and then also for myself. There's no question, as a caregiver to somebody who's had a long history with mental health issues, you are going to inevitably have some form of something yourself. Yeah. So for me, it's occasional depression and serious anxiety that I didn't even know was happening because I was always taking care of him. So it didn't catch me until I slowed down in my own life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how long have you and your husband been together?
Okay. I know it's going to sound like I was a child bride, but we have been married for 27 years.
Oh, wow.
I know, really. It's kind of cool. We were set up on a blind date and by a bunch of friends that he knew and that I knew. It was like groups. It was kind of funny. And both of us were like, nah, we don't want to do that, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then we went on a date. It was a weekend-long event at the college we went to. And it was
your
fine.
Your first date was a weekend-long?
Yeah.
That is a momentous first date.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're either going to like each other or not, right?
I mean, you're going to know.
Yeah, so I went to Louisiana State University, which is, you know, one of the ginormous state schools, and sports and Greek life were huge. And so at the time, we were members of sororities and fraternities, and there was this event called South Seas where the entire Greek area of the university turned into island homes. It was crazy.
Oh my gosh.
I know. I'm sure lots of good and bad things happened at that, but I tell you what, Disney World could learn a lot from a bunch of fraternity boys because they built some stuff that was really cool.
So was it just an immediate connection and you just kept dating from there?
It was not, only because I am super focused when I'm super focused, and my brain was in school. And even though I was in a sorority at the time, my sorority was the smart girl sorority. We were super book smart, and I just didn't really have time for doing all that wild stuff. Right. And so I had a lot of fun, but then like it was spring break and I had my wisdom teeth out and we saw each other somewhere, and I remember, you know, he was like, hey, can I buy you a drink? And I wasn't drinking because I was taking antibiotics. And at the time, I was a super duper good rule follower.
I was going to say, I'm really impressed that in college, you were not drinking.
Yeah.
Because you were taking antibiotics, like that you took that to heart, and that in all of your surroundings and everything that was going on.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was kind of funny because he thought I didn't like him. Apparently, just like you, he also was like, is she crazy? That's loony. Like, why wouldn't she want to drink? That's nuts. I mean, I was in a bar with people. I was just the designated driver. So it took like another month for him to try again. And that time I was like, I should go out. I should go out with him. He seemed like a really nice guy. And I remember he came to pick me up with daisies. And that was the kicker. I was like, daisies.
So sweet.
What a cool dude. Like, he didn't show up with a bunch of roses. He wasn't trying to woo me in that crazy way. It was like simple and real. And to this day, I tell people that when I met him, he was the sweetest down-to-earth person I've ever met, like ever. Gentle soul, all that good stuff. And so that was it. Then it was on for, you know, we dated for the next couple of years. And then my senior year in college, he asked me to marry him on my sorority front porch, not porch. What do you call it? Grass is the sorority houses at LSU are on a lake. It's really cute. It's perfect. It's exactly.
I mean, I'm picturing this, and it everything you're talking about. It's just kind of this very rom-com setting, story kind of thing.
It is. I will totally send you a picture of that event because they have resurfaced recently. People have found them in scrapbooks. And because, you know, during the pandemic, nobody has anything to do but go through their old stuff, right? So people have been posting pictures of things and someone's like, who is this? I can't believe this is Jillian and Heath. And indeed, we do look like we're children getting engaged. But yeah, so... you know, we had the whole regular, like, year-long engagement thing. I don't exactly know. Yeah, it was a little over a year.
When did any kind of mental health issues arise? I mean, is that something that you were just always aware of, was always a part of your relationship, or was there a time when it became more obvious?
Right. No, it absolutely was not at all a part of our relationship as we were dating. So it's pretty amazing that... We dated for about 4 years, but we didn't live together at all during college. And so, like, you wouldn't notice things, partly, truthfully, because he was living a guy in college's lifestyle. He was in a fraternity. They were a little bit of party boys. And so he was living that lifestyle, and I was living the book smart girl lifestyle. And so I didn't realize things that were going on that were mental healthy because I was not there usually when that would happen. I was already back. And we didn't have cell phones back then. We didn't even have our own phones. So people just had to deal with, I guess, whatever. But and also age-wise, you know, a lot of mental health issues do not show up until your early 20s. So our first year of marriage, we got married in 1992. In July, and I'm pretty sure in November was his first hospitalization. I was away doing, I was one of my first jobs. You had to go away and train for like 6 weeks. And they would let you go home, and they would also fly up your person, you know, in that time frame. But on one of my trips home, it was November around Thanksgiving, and I went home and he was a big mess. And obviously during that time while I was away, we did speak on the phone. Because we did have phones. And I knew things weren't right, but still he could make it sound like things were a little bit better and that he had a handle on it himself. He was holding a job. So it wasn't things that now are so much easier to see. That's also part of it. So I think he was like 22. And it bears saying that there is no question. So he also has a traumatic brain injury from a very, very serious fall.
When did that happen?
That happened when he was a senior in high school. So I did not know him then.
So still before you guys met. This all, yeah.
Yeah, a lot. Well, if you think about how our lives are determined, so much stuff happens before anybody knows, right?
Yeah.
So he had an accident. He was a football player. And he was one of the top football players in the state, if not the country at the time. Of course, I didn't know anything about this because really your only news source was the newspaper. So that wasn't in my family's world. We didn't care about that kind of stuff. And we just didn't know anything about it. And he was on his senior trip in high school. We live in Louisiana, and the closest place is Florida, so that's where they all went. And he fell off a balcony, over a balcony, in the middle of the night, off a fourth story balcony. You know, it's the thing that for the longest time, I don't know how I didn't really ever think it would impact him so much, but very. Very clearly, if you fall four stories and you land on your face and you survive, you've got a frontal lobe injury for sure.
Okay, but at that time, I don't think people talked about TBIs the way they talk about them now.
No, not at all.
And if I were you, I'd think, oh, that happened. And he's been okay for years.
Correct.
And I would just go on, assuming that's how it was going to
be. He also looked fine. I know that sounds silly, but... At whoever the plastic surgeons were that did all the work, they put him back together. I mean, he has scars in his arms and his legs. But because I know that, you know, when you meet somebody and you're falling in love and you're at that late teen, early 20 age, you don't go, well, something is going to happen later for sure from this. You don't ever think that. You're just like, right. Oh, he's still the nicest, sweetest guy down to earth I've ever met. So we sort of just banked it. We didn't even think about it. We didn't talk about it much.
So I was just going to jump forward just a little bit. So he's hospitalized for the first time. Mm. You guys have been married for a few months and you are in the middle of a postgraduate program.
At the time I was not in postgraduate. I was working. It was a training program. I was finishing towards the end of finishing it.
Gotcha. Just the timing of that is so heavy. How did you, as his spouse, as a newlywed, as a young woman, how are you handling that?
You know, I'll be really honest. I did what I have done most of my life, which I've learned serves me well sometimes, but also it's okay to loosen the reins a little bit sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that I did what I flew home. I helped him get into a hospital with my sister's help. She came up and met me. We took care of any mess at our house. And within 2 days I was back at my job in Alabama in another state training, because I was like, I only have 2 more weeks of this. So I'll just do what I have to do. And I managed from there. They gave me a little bit of a break to come home the next weekend also and make sure he was okay. And we did that. And then when I came back, I went to work and also tried to help him navigate post-hospital life, because he was hospitalized for a couple weeks because it was kind of severe. And back then they also did let people were hospitalized for a little bit longer, but it was, since it was his first hospitalization, and as you could imagine, he had so much stuff, it actually took a lot to unpack. So how I managed it was just like, I was like, okay, I just do what I'm supposed to do and go forward. And I honestly don't remember I know for sure that job did not last forever. When I got back, I did work it, but it was kind of one of those like, first job out of college jobs, you know, like that kind of thing. And so it wasn't my dream job forever anyways. I was good at it. I remember that. And so it worked and they let me do what I needed to do, but also his needs weren't that drastic then, because the mental health care system itself was so poor, if that makes any sense. Like there was no real continuing therapy or anything like that. So
they basically discharged him from the hospital and then said,
see ya.
Go on with
your life. Yeah, let us. Well, you know, they put him on meds. I think he saw a psychiatrist every month or so, and then he seemed stable a little bit. So it was until the next hospitalization that someone was like, "Oh, maybe this is a little more serious." He was also given wrong diagnoses at the time, but it was what was easily accessible for his age, for beginning of symptomology and things like that coming out. And so he was getting bits of help, there's no question, along the way. But I would say, so that was 1992. And I did go into my master's program in August of 1993. And that was when we started getting him more serious help, like more therapy, we were on the same insurance. He could get it through the university, and they have a student health center that actually has always had a really good mental health system.
Well, and that's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that you had access to insurance is huge. And I feel like that's just necessary to point out in this. In a lot of conversations I'm having in these newer episodes, there's a lot of talk around therapy. And most people that I am talking to have been able to get the therapy they need. And I don't think people always realize what a privilege that is and how many people have no way to access that.
I absolutely agree with you 100%. And I even think that's partly why you're getting to reach out to people like us, is because people like us who have had this privilege are able to come to a place where they can sit down and talk to somebody about this. a little bit easier than folks who are still in the middle of chaos.
I by no means want to cast a, some sort of light on this as if you were lucky in this situation. It has come up so much and I have yet to acknowledge that, that there are so many people that don't have access to insurance and cannot afford mental health care.
And I also think in some weird ways for some, I don't know how, because I certainly grew up in a family that did not talk about their shit ever. Like nobody talked about anything, which is why truthfully, I always joke that, you know, I became an advocate for him, but then I realized shit, some of this is for me. Because I wasn't seeking help until really bad stuff happened ever.
That was one of my questions. How long into, how long it took you to then seek help for yourself?
Oh, God. Years and years and years. Yeah. Mainly because it was time consuming. And I really did grow up in my family will love this part. I grew up in a family that didn't talk about their stuff. Very often they still don't. Even though
I feel
like they say they do. They got very frustrated. One of the reasons you found me as Mental Health Wife on Instagram is because on Facebook, I look like just every other white woman who might have a master's degree or a PhD. Truth.
Because your family won't like if you change your handle.
Not so much they wouldn't like it. Just the way they interact with things is different. God bless my father is, he's 80 something now. So he is, luckily he's alive and he's on these Facebook things, but you know, he responds inappropriately because he feels like he's texting you directly if you say something. So I realized that I couldn't share very much personal stuff. Even if I wanted to, I could say screw it, right? We can all say screw it. However, in terms of my abilities to really make some change for other people, not just myself, I felt like moving to Instagram for that would allow me to meet a wider spectrum of folks, help people better, and
create a safer space.
Yeah, and it really has because in many ways, there have been times I've shared about my own personal struggles and or challenges and how I've had to overcome them. But one thing I don't want to, I really want to go back to the whole thing also about having access to therapy is that I was in a master's program for social work. So I was really aware about it. Yeah. I think the majority of students on that same campus did not know about it. And that because I was embroiled in this every day, I just was like, well, duh, half my friends are doing internships there. That's where you're going to go. So whether that is fortuitous, it is also quite obviously privileged that I was there in the first place. And just in our case, super life-saving. So that's another blessing.
So your own struggles are masked for years because you were thrust right away into being a caregiver.
Yes.
And being in, and were you already, was it always the plan to go into social work for you?
No, actually, which is why I, after college, I sort of bounced around. I did get my degree was in psychology and political science. And originally I was going to actually be the first woman president. So there's that. I intended to
I would
do,
vote for you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty fun and cool and real. Yeah. And at least, I know what I know and I don't know what I don't know. So that's a good thing. but along the way, I remember deciding law school. It was literally my choice was law school. In my head, my choice was law school or MSW. And so I took the test for law school. Totally was fine. Great. You know, could get into a bunch of places. But here's the kicker. You'll maybe appreciate it or not, but the kicker is I had six friends who graduated with me undergrad who went to law school prior to me. It was about a year and a half time frame that I was taking to get married, settled, whatever, and then decide the stuff. And I had six friends and three of them were already divorced that went to law school, three of the women friends. And I remembered hearing, if you go to law school, you have to be prepared to make that your thing. Like that's it. And in my head, I was like, well, how can I do that if I know that my marriage might be a little bit more time consuming than other people's? Like, I just don't want that. So I chose family first. There was just no question. And I was like, oh, okay, I can probably get to the same place if I do this master's in social work. And I don't know that I was intending to be a social worker, which is why, as you may or may not know, I don't know if I talk about it a lot on social media, I really have come back to mental health advocacy the long way around by like going and getting a PhD immediately after my master's in social work, which is not what people did back in the 90s. Now people go directly through school, but back then you worked for like 10 years, then you went back. So I was like, I was the youngest person in my class in my PhD program, which didn't bother me at all. Yeah, and I did all that and became more of a researcher about things. But I was always wanting to be, I was the researcher who wanted to be with the people. Like, I still wanted to make a difference. And I didn't feel like writing about them was making enough of a difference for them.
Yeah.
So well,
part of the reason I asked was I wondered if Heath's struggles influenced you in choosing that. And it sounds like it did.
Sure.
But not really. Not the way that I was thinking. Like, it didn't in the sense that you wanted to put family first. You wanted to make sure you had enough time to be with him and to be a proper caregiver, but and wife. I don't want to keep lumping you into the caregiver category. But it wasn't necessarily because he was going through what he was going through that you chose that route.
Right. Okay. And actually, also, his struggles that became much more vivid and serious later were not as clear than even then. Like, he didn't really get sick in the way of needing to be in a hospital for another year and a half kind of thing. So it was while I was in my master's program. It definitely was not a decider. And as a kid, I don't think I even knew what a social worker was. I didn't even know people went to school for that. So it just kind of, it was one of those things that just kind of happened along the way.
Yeah. I am really curious about this from a standpoint of, from maybe this is two parts. One, how it was for you to fall in love with a person, and then be married to somebody a little bit different. I don't know if you would necessarily say he was a different person, but just he took a different kind of energy, different kind of focus from you.
Yeah.
That's one question I have. And the other question is how along the way you started learning how to take care of yourself.
Oh, that's definitely two different questions for sure for
me.
The first, it's funny. So I feel like we started out a little heavy about him, and that is partly because of what I know now. But honestly, I'm not gonna lie. Heath is one of the most charismatic, magnetic people on earth. Again, the guy that showed up with the daisies, he really is. Blonde hair, blue eyes, says all the right things. Maybe not so much now, because let's be real, after being married for 27 years, you say whatever you want to say. But back then, he was the life of the party, every party, everybody's party. He started the parties. And I don't always mean drinking parties. I just mean anything. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, you want to grill this weekend? Let's grill. You guys want to go do this weekend? Let's do this. You want to go running? Let's do this. He was very active and super fun and dynamic. And so am I. So in that aspect, we were really, really attracted to each other because we both brought that same energy to everything we did. And I'm pretty sure, I look back at it and I'm thinking about the different people who set us up and I'm like, that's what they saw. No wonder they did that. However, we could not be two different, more different people than walk this planet. Like, I am very, very extroverted. He is super introverted, and always was really introverted. He was the life of the party, but then that was it. Like, then he was like, okay, I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to read a book for 2 days. See y'all later.
Oh, so he'd kind of recover. Like, he'd do it and enjoy it and then recover.
Yeah, definitely. And also we both were just, we came from completely different lives and lifestyles. Like, he lived in the same place his whole life, and I lived all over the country. I have 4 siblings. He has 1. And, you know, all, like, literally all the things that you could think of that could be separate are separate. He came from the country. I came from the city. We used to joke we were country mouse, city mouse all the time when we were first starting out, because we kept finding out new stuff about each other, which was, I think that when you say, what was it like? I would say the first bunch of years dating and being married was still like, wow, this is really cool. Like, yeah. I just remember driving to where his family lived, and some of them still do, where you'd get off a main road and then drive another hour and then drive another hour to another road where, like, forget about anything except seeing trees. And then you get to a teeny tiny little town. And for me, that was sort of, wow, this is the coolest thing ever. Like, we're out in the middle of nowhere. Nobody even knows we're here. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas for him, it was like, but that's how it is. So, I think that there was just that, for sure, that initial magnetism of both of us and then towards mm-hmm. each other. And then the whole, we have our moments of super opposites and then super, similar. And that, I think, you know, you have like your energy that's on top of your body that everyone sees, but then you also have all these layers of currents running underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we matched on so many levels. And then the ones that we didn't match on are the ones we actually, believe it or not, are just still figuring it out, which is why it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So does that answer your first question ish?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm actually going to ask my second question again, because they are really so different. I probably said it so I wouldn't forget it. But first, in response to that, what, you know, since you guys have both things that are very similar and very different, like, what do you do? What do you enjoy doing together?
Okay. Yeah. And that also has changed over time, because mm-hmm. as his illness took precedence in our space of our home mm-hmm. and our life, he doesn't not go out anywhere anymore. Like, that's something that happens. So things that we like to do together are listen to music mm-hmm. together. You can put some classical music on and we will sit for an entire day and read books, or I'll draw or paint, and he'll read books. And
it sounds relaxing.
Yeah. It was something we loved when we lived in Boston. We really, really ate up the classical music scene and the jazz music from New Orleans, you know, now that we're here. So both of us are very drawn towards music, and that's something we love to do. And we love grilling. We love being outside. And mm-hmm. so because he is not going out places, which partly pandemic, partly anxiety, you know, that was starting for him before the pandemic even started. So he doesn't go very far, but you can do magical stuff in any size outdoor spot that you can find. If you give this man a grill, he will cook you a feast. So that's the kind of stuff that we can just sit outside and watch the fire for hours also, and talk about stuff still, you know.
I love that. And I think that really highlights the idea that we get so lost sometimes in our to and fro of our day-to-day lives that mm-hmm. there's just an incredible amount of joy right around us. And I think during this absolutely. Pandemic, we're all forgetting that, you know, in our own backyard.
We are absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons we moved. Like, you know, we've talked about that we moved last month, was that the joy in our own backyard went away because of some external people and things that were out of my control. So I was like, well, guess what? We're going to move somewhere then, because that's what you do. And the space we have, it's not the hugest backyard, but you know what? It is perfect. And, it's private and we love it, and we get to do what we need to do. And literally, you know, I have friends who have seen a, you know, a couple pictures I've taken back there, and they're like, so do you live on a river? I was like, no, it's actually probably, I think it's a drainage creek for the city, but it does look like a creek. I'm not exactly sure, you know, and I haven't really figured it all out, but it's all perspective, you know?
Absolutely.
And we're not going to not go outside because of it. It's beautiful. And we did live on a river at one point. So, I bring up memories sometimes for that.
But you did, just to touch on the move, that was an unexpected move. And in the middle of a pandemic.
Yes.
Holy cow. So. How was that? Especially if Heath is getting, you know, he's very comfortable in his own places, his spaces.
Yeah.
How was that managing a move? I mean, you had so many factors against you in doing that. Time frames, pandemic, you know, so many things.
Economics, it's fair to say, yes. Economics also, yeah. at the time. I mean, there's no question. It was horrible. I feel like, you know, it's really neat that as we talked, this whole beginning has been really nice for me because I'm like remembering a lot of really positive things. Mm. And then the reality though of what happens when I think about now is harder with Heath, doing all the things with Heath, let's just say that. So the move was super horrible. It was in no way fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a horrible move, period. There are times where people say, you know, everyone's like, oh, moving's so bad. And I'm like, yes, moving is so bad. But when you have like physical and sort of energetic threats coming at you from your so-called neighbors who, you know, we were renting and just happened that the landlord also owned the next house and that the neighbors in the next house are some form of unwell people and continued to harass us and also then eventually vandalize our home a couple times. And when the landlord finally wasn't going to do anything about it, I thought, okay, well then we just have to really move. Like I have to make sure we're safe. Yeah. And I just going back to, this is what I love your podcast, Dismantling Normal. So my family kept saying, you can't move. You don't have a job. How can you move when you don't have a full-time job? Mind you, I had some contracts, but it isn't a full-time job. It isn't the same thing. And my family just was like, everyone in my family was like, well, why don't you get a job and then move? And I'm like, well, because I don't know what these people are going to do next. And it's becoming so uncomfortable. And he is actually not safe in his own space now. Mm-hmm. So I felt that it was my duty, to just make sure we found a safe space. And truthfully, what was not horrible about it was that as things very often go for me, the minute I actually make a decision that is right and aligned with what I'm supposed to be doing, things just fall into place, whether that is the universe taking care of me and having my back, or me being the kind of person that knows a lot of people. There were an acquaintance, not even a good friend, just an acquaintance said, hey, we have an Airbnb that we haven't been able to rent for the whole year. And we were thinking about turning it into a full-time rental. Do you want to come look at it? I was like, sure. Wow. And that is where we actually are now. And it is beautiful and wonderful and super light-filled. And it is the right space for us. But doing the actual move and the 2 weeks up until the move were horrendous. I had to call upon literally every favor I could come up with in my head. And you know, I'll say, I feel like my family scooped in. And I say that I really mean my sisters. They just literally scooped in. They came and they helped me pack for days and days on end. And Heath would have to go in like one room and shut the door and be by himself because he couldn't handle all the commotion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and because of the pandemic, like you said, it was weird and different. I couldn't just bring him to the library. So the library used to be one of our great joys. I didn't even mention that before. Mm-hmm. But because of the pandemic, although I'm sure going to a library is safe for some, I don't feel like it's probably the best thing to do for someone who hasn't really left the house much in a year to just be like, hey, see you in 8 hours. We're going to pack.
I'm leaving you here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like, let's be smart about how we manage this. So we did. And then getting here, like literally to the day, like 2 days before we were going to rent a truck to move, I finally decided, I'm like, I know everyone says I don't have money for this, but we're getting movers because we're all tired. We're doing this like under the gun. I called a moving company who said they didn't have anything until like a month from then, but they just happened to have a cancellation in 2 days. Could we be ready in 2 days? And I was like, well, why the heck not? Let's just do it. Well, I was like, well, have them move all the heavy stuff. And, you know, we had a lot packed by then, just not everything. And so we did it. And it was, you know, pouring down rain because that happens here. Then we did have to continue moving for days. But by then I had keys here. So we brought Heath here and he was able to be comfortable. And the dog was here with him. Our blue dog that we love so much was here with him. And so that all worked out really well. I mean, what is it now? September 10th. It's taken.
What is it now? It's been 3 years since.
Exactly. I'm like.
Quarantine started.
Right. Exactly. So I'm like, so it really has taken us a month and a half to start getting comfortable. If that makes sense.
You know, how long was it after you moved that the hurricane hit? Really?
Oh, that was 2 weeks ago. So that was, yeah. And while we were spared, technically in Baton Rouge, 2 hours to the west of us is completely devastated and demolished. Mm-hmm. And multiple friends of ours, you know, families' homes are gone. But during that week, though, what we did have because of it was we had orders from, you know, state officials that were like, okay, wherever you are now, stay for 48 hours. So it was like, hurry up and wait, hurry up and wait. And so in the beginning of the week, it was Sunday, Monday, everybody stay where you are. If you're not evacuating, stay where you are. And at the time they thought it was hitting New Orleans, and we're in between New Orleans and then where the other Hurricane Laura did hit on Wednesday night. But we had the tropical winds and everything that you get when you're, when it's that big of a hurricane. And, you know, I literally remember waking up on Thursday going, are we okay? We have power. Wow. And you know, again, super grateful and really joyful because that's what happens when you find out everything's okay. But the amount of anxiety and agita that creates in your life is pretty kooky, right? So yeah, so that was just 2 weeks ago, to be honest with you.
What is agita?
It may be a made-up word, or it's an Italian word. I'm not sure. One of my best friends from grad school used to say it all the time, and it just means you're like about to like lose your shit, like okay. But I think it might actually be an Italian word or whatever. So I'm Jewish, and we have Yiddish. Whatever the form of that is for her family, because they were seriously like heavy-duty Italian.
Okay.
Yeah, Robin, if you are listening to this, please tell us what agita really means. Yeah,
that's great.
And isn't that cool how like things stick with you? Like, I haven't talked to her in so long, but it just came out while we're talking. That's awesome.
All right, I can't close this out without asking you how you have learned in the middle of all of this to take care of yourself, your own mental health, your own self-care.
Yes, it's funny. I just saw how long we've been talking. I am assuming we could talk for days.
I think
so. We could. We could do a whole series on each other probably. So one thing that it's like literally, you know, people call it their tools. I hate to use that word because I just don't think of myself as a tool master. I don't know. Maybe it's a paint box or a toy. Mine's probably a toy box. So my toys that help me get through things really is what it is. One is always finding the simple joys, like you said. I don't think I ever referred to it as the simple joys, but I know my family and many people who know me would always say I have a positive outlook and or and or that I have rose-colored glasses on. Well, mm-hmm. you know what? Sometimes those rose-colored glasses come in really handy if it's for like an hour to get you through some stupid shit or something really horrible. Because the truth is, and what I think my answer is that to keep going, my answer to that question is that, you know, life is always going to change and throw new things at us. If we have learned anything from this pandemic, it is that all the things that all of us thought were certain are in no way certain, right? So when I think about how I handle uncertainty now versus how it was when I was 22, you know, now I fall on meditation all the time. I use it all the time, but it's probably not the pretty woo-woo kind of meditation a lot of people think about. Sometimes it is literally sitting at a stoplight and going, oh, that stop sign is red and there's four letters on it. Like I just go, I become aware of what I'm seeing.
You like zone in.
Yeah, like, okay, I am actually driving in this car, you know?
Like hyper aware of the very, very most present things.
Yeah, because that lets me like come back to truth, come back to myself. And I guess that is also, that is the bigger answer, is that what I think is that I always come back to myself. Like even in the times where we had super heavy duty caregiving times, or I was writing my dissertation and I had to be up for 3 days writing, I always found a way to come back to myself. And it usually was getting quiet, whether it was listening to music or putting my feet in water. Water has always been myself. And I've learned that if you don't have an ocean or a river by you, you can literally put your feet in the bathtub and it's water and your feet know that they're in water. And it's this amazing, soothing, same memory, same feeling thing that that pulls me back. So while I say meditation, I know everybody doesn't have time to sit down for 30 minutes every day. And I don't either. And I don't always do it.
Well, one of the things I've had to replace, I've had to replace the ideas I have around meditation, that you're sitting in a quiet room, you know, in with your legs crossed and saying om, and, you know, there's just far greater ideas and ways to meditate than this very strict, like, image I've always had in my mind.
Like walking. Walking meditation is actually a form of Buddhist meditation, and they do it all the Buddhist monks, they go walking around the monasteries in silence, and it's about noticing that you're putting the ball of your foot down or the heel of your foot down, and going so slow that you actually notice that. So I have found that while sometimes I like to get my jam on and listen to really kick-ass music while I'm walking, I also sometimes don't even put music on and I just walk. And when I do that, I always notice a new bird that like has probably been in my neighborhood forever, but I never noticed, or, you know, something along those lines. I always find something that draws my attention visually, usually when I do that. But so the self-care of letting myself find a way to get what I need. And if that is taking a bath, it is not always the bubble bath situation, like you said. And also finding something outside. I think I've referred to outside a lot and during our whole talk. So I think those are the things. And laughing. Man, you gotta laugh. Like if you can't laugh at yourself, then really it's gonna be a rough, rough time.
It's amazing how cathartic both laughing and crying are. Like absolutely. Sometimes after a really hard laugh or a really hard cry, I feel similarly. Like absolutely. I'm cleansed.
Yeah. No, it is, because it's the same thing as also you could, another thing I have been known to do, is just shake everything for a minute. Like if you just stand there and you shake everything, or if you lay, some people can't do it standing. If you lay on your back, I do it a lot of times on the floor, lay on my back and put my hands up, and you look like a dead bug, and you just shake your hands and your feet. And it is similarly cathartic, but there's no question it's the release of something that lets me come back to myself enough to be present for what needs to happen next, or in the present moment, even what the next step is in that present moment that will bring what we need, you know, whether it's conclusion or figuring something out, you know, all of those different things can happen. But when you're actually present and not just like flying, because someone like me who is supernaturally excitable, I suppose you could say. I am excitable, very easily excitable. It is definitely the coming back to home and going, okay, here I am. I am here. That has always helped me.
Well, before we officially close things out, and yes, I could talk to you for many more hours. I don't know if anyone would listen to us if we just went on, if this whole podcast was like 3 hours long.
Right.
But is there anything just, you know, that you haven't gotten to say that you wanted to, whether it's about mental health in general, or whether it's about your own situation or your marriage, or, you know, just parting words of wisdom?
Absolutely. Because I think about the title of your podcast a lot, and it's Dismantling Normal. And I think about the fact that you were thinking about this and growing this seed for years, like before this ever really came to reality. And then of course, now we have the pandemic and everyone's saying the word normal, new normal, not normal, what's normal, all this normal everywhere. And the truth is that I don't think there is a normal. I think that normal to what people think they're calling normal is their comfort zone. It's what they're comfortable with. And I was thinking about it. Yeah. I was thinking about it the other day, and I was like, because there isn't normal. Everybody's normal is totally different. So it's like what your normal might have been was what you were comfortable with, what my normal is. And so it has been a theme of my life that I've never done anything the normal way. And sometimes I've been told that I don't do it the easy way. And I'm like, so is it that I don't do it the easy way, or I don't do what you think is the normal way?
Yeah. You're playing into something that when you said it's their comfort zone made me realize also about the whole idea of unraveling our ideas of normal.
Yeah.
Is that I think where we get stuck on normal is, hey, if you want to think your comfort zone is normal, great. But don't feel like you have to pull me into the same comfort zone for you to then also feel comfortable with what's happening in my life.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we really get caught, is not accepting that, not feeling whole and in a sense of assuredness that this is the way I'm going to do my life because this is the zone I'm comfortable in. And then looking out at somebody else and saying, okay, and since I'm good here and I'm strong here, I'm okay with them doing their life way different, and that they're okay, I'm okay.
Yes. Yes.
But we don't, and I'm guilty of it too. I mean, I only know this because I've done it. But, you know, we want to pull people to our side and be like, no, do it how I'm doing it so that I feel good about it.
Right.
And that's just not what it's about.
Absolutely. No, I agree 100%. I don't know that. And I think then what is happening right now, partly due to the pandemic and partly due to different people coming to their own awareness that there isn't really a normal, is that we're all finally going, oh, wait, I'm okay. I am worthy still, even though I didn't do the normal thing, or even though what my life looks like is not what somebody who would expect it to look like had they done all the same things I did, had, you know, school-wise or professional-wise or whatever. Their normal is going to look different than my normal. So, you know, I just love the notion of unraveling normal. because really it wasn't there in the first place. And I hope more and more people see it, but also then become comfortable with who they are regardless.
Yes. And I think that's the root. It's not even so much, you know, worrying about somebody else. It's the more comfortable you get in your own normal or abnormal or weird or whatever you want to call it. If you just get really firm and rooted in the idea, and when I say you, I mean me, but the more rooted I get in, and this is where I'm at and this is what I want to do and these are the choices I want to make, the more you are willing to allow everyone else to make their own choices and that you're cheering them on and doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yes.
Well, thank you so, so much. This has been such a long time in coming, but it's just the right time.
Absolutely.
It worked out perfectly.
It is always the right time when things finally do happen for whatever reason. So I just appreciate you talking with me. It was so much fun.
I loved having you on here. So I hope you, start feeling better. I hope the dizziness goes away.
I hope that it does too. It would be amazing if it goes away after we're done talking. That would be one of those like dingers to me that goes, oh, you were supposed to do this and you were so afraid that like a physical manifestation happened. So I will let you know if that happens in the next few hours or even day. But I really appreciate you, Megan. You're amazing.
Well, I really appreciate you. You're an amazing person. And yeah, thanks for being on, Jillian.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Let's keep this conversation rolling. For questions and comments, find us on Facebook, Instagram, @DismantlingNormal. Visit our website, dismantlingnormal.com, for the show notes and extra links. See you next time. Have a great day, guys.